Professor Paul Moon is with us for a recording. It's been a while since I've had a chat with Paul, but he is a prolific author and for a long time has been at AUT. Paul, New Zealand historian, professor at Auckland University of Technology. He's a writer specialising in Māori history, and it's wonderful to have another kōrero with you after what seems far too long. Thanks for your time this morning, Paul. Tēnā koe.
Kia ora, Dale. It's been a long time.
Yeah. I don't know what's happened, Paul. And I'm looking forward to this conversation.
I got the hint.
Oh, I don't think so. I've had nothing to do with that.
I'm joking.
Sort of fell away a little bit. But, mate, thanks again. You're still in the chair. You've been at AUT for a long time. And, you know, putting together challenging perspectives at times, but perspectives we can benefit from. I'm trying to unravel, and the latest too with this fourth article is an example of that. What's been keeping you busy since last we spoke? I mean, how many books have you written since I've spoken with you, mate?
I'm not sure really, but there's always something on the go, that's for sure.
Well, big ups to you. Professor Paul Moon is urging the Waitangi Tribunal to clearly state its position on the so-called fourth article of the Treaty of Waitangi, which he argues has no historic or legal foundation. Many people won't be familiar with the term, the fourth article. Paul, if you'd be so kind.
Sure. Well, this was something that was actually made up. We can trace it to the early 1990s. A group of Catholic priests got together and they decided that their bishop, Pompallier, in 1840, had asked Hobson at the time of the first signing, Catholic, those chiefs have become Catholics, are they covered by the treaty? And Hobson responded effectively saying, Catholics are, Protestants are, those chiefs who keep their traditional beliefs, everyone's covered by the treaty. Every hapu that commits to it is covered by it. And the treaty wasn't really a religious, in the sense of guaranteeing religious freedoms, it was more about guaranteeing sovereignty. And that was it. That conversation took place. Lots of conversations, as we know, took place at Waitangi and other signings. Then in 1990, this group of bishops said, this is an article guaranteeing religious freedom, and it should now be added to the treaty. And the tribunal has been a bit, let's say, flexible with the evidence. They've said, well, maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. They've used it in some cases. And now some government agencies have used it, and it's got into the bloodstream. And I think the concern is, and we have to be very clear about this, that the treaty is what the chiefs agreed to. And you know, a very good example is the very first chief who signed it, Honeheke, who said, when he wrote his name on that text, he said, I signed this with my hand, but with the mana of my ancestors. And he mentioned a couple of ancestors, Kaharo and Koteawhā, two very famous Ngāpuhi chiefs. He invested his mana in that agreement, what was written. And I remember talking to one of the members of his hapu, Graham Rankin, who passed away about 25 years ago. And he said that there was no fourth article. He said it wasn't part of our oral history. Our ancestors never mentioned it. And I think that's really the challenge for the tribunal that started to promote this fourth article. They have to go to those hapu and say, your ancestor who signed the treaty, who was there, they're wrong. Your oral histories are wrong, but we're right. And this is essentially what the tribunal is saying to these hapu. And I think they need to be a bit clearer about their position on this.
Yeah, tēnā koe. It's not an issue that we speak of too regularly, but what we do know is that there has been some pushback against the Waitangi Tribunal having modern-day interpretations of the treaty. There's still a very vexed issue about interpretation of the treaty, which one has sedence over the other internationally, whether the Reo Māori version is the one that should be referred to, and now issues of the fourth article. Might we see more of these types of considerations, or does this critique aim to lessen the way that the tribunal and others utilise this term, the fourth article? You're saying it was never part of the treaty. Are you anticipating it's going to be used more often in a modern context, Paul?
I think we're probably reaching a tipping point now where the fourth article probably in the next 5-10 years, will start to fade away. But the point you made about the tribunal is crucial. The tribunal should be our top authority when it comes to treaty interpretation, and I'm afraid that they're not where they ought to be. And you can look at this very clearly, the issue of sovereignty. Did the chief cede sovereignty in 1840? Well, the tribunal sort of had a bob each way in some aspects of this, but the evidence is absolutely clear. And here's another challenge. You know, name me one chief who said, you know what, I'm tired of having all this mun and sovereignty over my people. I'm going to hand it over to the small group of migrants. They can run my hapu from now on. I mean, that's absurd. You won't find one chief who agreed to surrender his sovereignty in 1840, let alone 542. So we need to be absolutely clear. The history is very clear that no sovereignty was ceded. Now, the tribunal needs to be just as clear when it's dealing with claims to take into account that fact. And I think it's part of a clearing up process. Yes, there's disputes about interpretation, but I think we're moving closer to agreement on all the main points, and we ought to be anyway.
Well, politically, it seems that there's a lot of concern about interpretation, and that the tribunal criticism from guys like Shane and others are that they're overreaching, Paul. And I mean, even the discussion of the potential ambiguity of a term like the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi is up for discussion. Are these valid points that surfacing publicly? And where do you think we're at with the way that we are adhering to or not to what the treaty implies?
Well, I think there are faults on all sides of the argument across the spectrum. And the reason for that is a lot of people, not all, but a lot of people say to themselves, I want the treaty to mean this. And then they'll go about collecting bits of information which prop up their particular interpretation. And when you look at it overall, the principles is a bit of a different issue because that's something that came about later. And there are substantial differences on that. Tuheiti has said, for example, the treaty is what was written and that's it. And that was his view of it. It's the text that the chiefs agreed to. But of course, we have principles that come later on. And so how those apply, that of course has been the subject of major dispute in recent years. But the tribunal has an obligation to adhere to the evidence, to stick to what we know to be correct. And on things like sovereignty, on things like the fourth article, there ought not to be this degree of argument. We need to be clear. Sovereignty wasn't ceded in 1840. Sovereignty was gradually ceded later on. There's evidence of that. There's a process of either through conquest or acquiescence that a lot of hapu did say, you know, the crown is now sovereign. That was later on. But in 1840, sovereignty wasn't ceded. We need to be very clear about these things. The evidence has got to the point now where it can't be challenged anymore.
Tēnā koe. What risks or misunderstandings arise when government agencies, I haven't heard too many referring to the fourth article in their policies or public statements, but what risks are there with this, and why is it important, perhaps even for the tribunal, Paul, to explicitly clarify its stance and the uncertainty that the current silence creates?
If you sign a hire purchase agreement and several years later you're still paying it off, and the hire purchase company comes to you and says, you know what, Bill, we've added something to our agreement. We didn't ask you, we just added it because we think it makes it better. You're not going to be very happy about that. You agreed to what you signed. And the problem is, once you open the door to changing the treaty, saying we're going to start adding a few more articles here and there, we're going to pretend there's a fourth article, maybe there's a fifth article. And by the way, there are people who are suggesting there are more than four articles. This is how dangerous it becomes. What happens is the mana of the agreement gets diluted. What the chiefs actually put their names to, what they discussed and debated and what they agreed to, becomes something different. And that's a real risk. I think if you take the treaty seriously, you have to do that. You can't start tacking bits onto the side, putting these lean-tos onto it and saying, well, it's also this and this and this. Nothing necessarily wrong with other ideas, but when you talk about the treaty, there has to be a degree of purity about the text, and I think that's what's at risk.
Tēnā koe, Paul, interesting stuff. Look, you and I, our careers have been intertwined with what's been movement across the understanding of treaty issues. Are we getting closer to the goal? What really is the goal? Is bringing us, our peoples together, the ultimate goal here? And how would you describe the last 30, 40 years that we've been involved, me in broadcasting, you in academia, with how we've witnessed the understanding, the utilisation, the tool that the treaty can be for our nation's present and future?
I've run this sort of experiment occasionally. I've talked to people who have been married 30, 40, 50 years, and I've said, what's your marriage been like? And they'll tell, we've done this, we've had our ups and downs, you know, it's been challenging, we had some good times, bad, so on. Not one person has ever said, my marriage are these vows, which is really interesting. And if you look at any sort of relationship, the document that forms the relationship is important, but the character of the relationship is what defines it, the experiences along the way. And there is a risk if you become overly focused on the treaty as something that existed in 1840, you can potentially risk losing the nature of the relationship since that time. And I think a lot of people, certainly a lot of iwi leaders, talk a lot about that relationship. Then you get to the second problem. Is it a relationship where both parties really want it to work, or has it become quite an adversarial relationship? Is it like a very protracted divorce? And you can see elements of both of those. Some of the rhetoric that comes out about the treaty makes it sound very much like a divorce. Some of it makes it sound like people trying to make the relationship work. And so where people are coming from and what they bring to the discussion and what they want out of it shapes the way we see these things.
Tēnā koe. Should we harbour some confidence that we are improving, that the treaty is actually helping to bind us, or is it, as some would suggest, still divisive?
So the text ought not to be divisive, but certainly you can bring ideas to the table that will cause division. If I say all people from this group should do this, who am I to say that? And that applies to everyone in a discussion. But I think if you approach it from the point of view of, you know, this relationship has to function, it has to function, there's no good alternative, then that shapes the way you start to apply the treaty. And I think, yes, there have been some problems and there have been some disputes and there's a lot of heat that's generated from some of this discussion, but at its heart, you'd have to say, compared with, say, the 1975, 1976, when the tribunal gets underway, things have changed enormously. If you go back to 1976, and knowledge about the treaty was almost zero for most people. Now it's embedded in lots of organisations and government departments. It's a part of the way people think about relationships that didn't exist before. But I were kept at arm's length. Now, in a lot of cases, mana whenua groups have a central role to play in various agencies. So, and that's, of course, changed the requirements for those mana whenua groups. And so all this has come about gradually, unevenly, sometimes awkwardly, but you can definitely track the change. And it seems to be, I think there's reason to be optimistic about it, seems to be the trajectory is heading in the right way, that people are becoming a bit more understanding of differences, a bit more interested in others, and a bit more keen to make the relationship work.
I've enjoyed talking with you again, Paul. Let's not leave our gaps between conversations so long next time. Good to catch up with you again, man. Thanks very much for your thoughts today, Paul.
Thank you. Talk to you later.
Tēnā koe.